Abbey 104.
Good morning, it's Abbey 104, 5 past 11 Sunday morning. I'm Terry Bennett and it's time for Folk Tales. And in the studio this morning I have Tim Phillips. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Terry.
And Tim, you are a member of the Abbey Bellringing community.
That's correct.
And I gather that's quite a group.
We are a group of probably 20, 25 people. We ring for Sunday services every Sunday morning. We ring practices on a Tuesday evening, and we obviously ring also for perhaps up to 20, 25 weddings a year and the occasional funeral.
And tell us a little bit about the bells of Sherborne Abbey. They're quite something, aren't they?
They are a historic and widely admired peal of eight bells. They're the heaviest peal of eight in the world. The tenor weighs roughly 2 1/3 tonnes. So you really know when you're on the end of the rope ringing that one. The treble, which is the lightest bell, weighs almost half a hundredweight.
I'm going to ask you throughout this interview a load of really basic questions, okay, because I don't know very much about bell ringing, and maybe we'll assume that other people don't as well. When you talk about a peal of eight bells,
yes,
not every church will have eight bells. There'll be different numbers in different churches.
Absolutely.
How do those vary?
They vary really for historical reasons. In early medieval times, there might have been one or two bells acting as a clock for people working in the fields. Later on, people worked out how they might ring those bells in what we call the English style, with a wheel mounted on the bell and the rope running around the wheel so that the bell could turn full circle. And that enabled changes to be rung. That developed over a period of many years. Probably in about the 1700s, method ringing became something that people aspired to do, and it's now very common, and we do it at the Abbey.
What do you mean by method ringing?
Method ringing is ringing effectively a sequence of changes which starts in rounds, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, finishes in rounds, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and develops a method of ringing that enables those patterns to be accomplished.
I see.
So method ringing is one thing. Call changes is the other type of ringing that's prevalent, especially in the West Country. We do some here, but it's more likely to be found in Devon and Cornwall.
Call changes.
Call changes, where a conductor says, gives a command that will swap two bells in the sequence. So instead of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, it might be 1, 3, 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And that can develop to be as complicated as you like, depending on the time you wish to ring.
And in terms of the number of bells each church would have,
yes,
Sherborne has eight.
Yes.
There would be bigger churches or cathedrals, presumably, would have more than eight, would they?
Not necessarily. It depends upon the manner in which the bells have evolved. So 160 years ago, there were just six bells in the Abbey. The front two were added in about 1858 from memory. And that pattern of adding bells to a number is one that has evolved over the whole country. Typically, as I said earlier, they started off with one or two and some have gone to three or four or five. Most are six. There are lots of eights. There are quite a few tens. There are a few 12s. I think Winchester's got 14, and there are 16 in St Martin's in the Bullring in Birmingham.
Showing off, is it?
Well, there are some very, very accomplished ringers who ring 16 bells.
I bet there are.
The more bells you have, the harder it is to ring methods on them, because the methods are far more complicated. And so if you want to ring in a 16-bell tower, you have to be a tip-top ringer.
And just going back to Sherborne is something special, as you say, because it's the heaviest peal of eight in the world.
It is, absolutely.
And how did that come about? So that wasn't by design, it's just happened, did it?
Not exactly. It was Cardinal Wolsey who bought a number of big bells from Tournai in France.
We're going back a while, aren't we?
Going back a while. This is the 1500s.
Sure.
And one of the bells he bought was one which weighed around 52 hundredweights, and he put it into Sherborne Abbey. Over time, that bell had to be broken up because it was too big for the tower to support it and the weight of other bells, and it was recast, and the recast bell is the one we have now, which weighs 46 hundredweight.
Still quite a size.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we should say that, leaning back a little minute, you've got a book that's been recently published called The Bells of Sherborne Abbey,
yes,
which is written by Peter Sewell and Catherine Barker.
Yes.
And we'll talk a little bit about that in due course as well, because that gives a complete comprehensive history, doesn't it, of
it does.
The bells in the Abbey.
Catherine's written the history of bells in their original occupation, if you like, as clock bells. And then Peter's developed that into the change ringing history, particularly of the bells in the Abbey here.
OK. We'll talk a little bit about you as well.
OK.
But before we do that, let's have your first track, and quite an appropriate one, really. You've chosen Lovely Day by Bill Withers.
Yes.
Just a favourite?
It's a favourite, Helen, my wife and I. It's a meaningful one for us. Basically, we're so lucky to be together and to live in Dorset, so we just like Lovely Day as a theme tune for our marriage.
It's as good a reason as any.
Absolutely.
When I wake up in the morning, love, and the sunlight hurts my eyes, something without warning, love, bears heavy on my mind. Then I look at you, and the world's all right with me. Just one look at you, and I know it's gonna be a lovely day. Instead of me, always seems to know the way. Then I look at you, and the world's all right with me. Just one look at you, and I know it's gone.
Yeah.
That's Bill Withers and Lovely Day, a hit for him in 1977. Chosen by my guests this morning in the studio, and that's Tim Phillips of the Sherborne Abbey bell ringing community. And Tim, we talked a little bit about the bells of Sherborne Abbey, and we'll get back to all of that, and there's some technical bits we can explore there, certainly. And we'll talk about the book as well. But let's just go back and look at you. You are not native to this part of the world, I believe.
I'm not native to Great Britain either. I was born in Londonderry,
Northern Ireland,
in 1948. My father was in the Navy. Mother was resident at home in Scotland, and when I was probably 6 weeks from being born, he brought her over to Londonderry. They set up themselves in a house not far from the city and county hospital where I was born, and then within about another 6 weeks we were back in Scotland. Father had a posting back to Forsyth Naval Base.
So you didn't stay in Northern Ireland?
We didn't stay very long.
No.
And sadly, I've never been back as yet, but that is on the bucket list.
And that was obviously in pre-Troubles days. So,
way before.
Yes,
way before.
Yeah, absolutely. So you ended up in Scotland?
Ended up in Scotland, lived in a village called Ely. There's a lot of family history around Ely, which I won't bore anybody with today, but the family home was in Ely, going back a few generations. We lived in a little cottage just round the back from there. And then moved across to be closer to Forsyth at a village called Limekilns. My sister at that time was about 1.5, and she enjoyed particularly climbing out of her cot. One morning, the grocer was walking up the path to the porch at the front of the house where my mother was standing, when she heard this voice from the window above calling to the grocer. And it turned out that Nina had climbed out of her cot and was sitting on the windowsill with the window open.
Right.
And Mother grabbed her and put her back in, thankfully just in time. So that was one episode. And I suppose we were there for three or four years, and then moved down to Gretton in Northamptonshire to be with my grandparents, my paternal grandparents, because Father was then posted onto HMS Barossa, a destroyer, battle-class destroyer, and was off to the Mediterranean and further afield.
And this would have been in the 50s, presumably?
In about 52-3, and was then away for a while. And when he came back, I'd since started at Gretton School at the age of 4 and a bit, which is a wonderful school and still exists to this day. And then when he returned from service abroad, he was stationed in Portsmouth, and we then went down to Pompey and lived in that area for many years, till I was 11.
Quite a lot of moving around then in your childhood.
A lot of moving around, yeah. I think about 10 houses by the time I was 11, but that's typical of a service life.
And is there a big military history in the family, or was your father the first?
My father's not the first. His father served in the Royal Army Medical Corps in the First World War and saw action in Egypt, among other places. My great-grandfather, on my grandmother's side, so her father, he ran away from home, we believe, at the age of 12 or 13. He chose to not tell the truth about how old he was or where he was born when he joined the Royal Navy. But he did extremely well as an ordinary seaman and ended up being promoted to gunner when his captain, a man called Buller, was promoted to Rear Admiral. That caused Captain Buller to have a superfluous naval sword, the pattern of sword for a rank officer, flag officer, is different to a captain or a lieutenant. So he donated the sword to Harry Barrett, my great grandfather. And then, of course, when Father joined the Navy in 1940 to serve in the Fleet Air Arm, he inherited the sword and used it throughout his career. And it now hangs in my hall.
Very
lovely.
A great keepsake, yes.
Great keepsake, yes. Yeah. Wonderful.
All right. So you were then in the Midlands.
Moved in the Midlands
and then down to Portsmouth. So yes. Where was your secondary education? That was in Portsmouth, was it?
It was. No, it wasn't. By that time, we'd moved up to Greyshot in Hampshire.
Right.
Another move to be the final one for 8 or 9 years.
And had father moved again at that point?
He'd retired from the Navy and had taken work in what was then called Stewarts and Lloyds, now part of British Steel, as was, in London, in central London. So they moved from the south coast to be near Haslemere Station, 1 hour from Waterloo, which suited him fine. As a result of which, my secondary education started at Church's College in Petersfield, and I was there for 7 or 8 years.
Lovely part of the world.
Beautiful.
What was the school like?
I didn't enjoy school much. I did enjoy the sport. The sporting life at Church's was wonderful, and it was augmented by active sports activities in Greyshot itself. You know, there was cricket, football, tennis, hockey, rugby union, all sorts of stuff one could do. So it's just wonderful.
And what sports did you excel at?
Cricket I was quite good at. I enjoyed cricket. I was an opening batsman for Greyshot. Right. And thoroughly enjoyed that. It used to be wonderful. Great fun.
Was there ever any sense that you were going to follow your father into the Navy?
I did talk to him about that when I was probably about 12 or 13. By which time I was wearing glasses, and that precluded me, he said, from being a watchkeeping officer, which meant that I would have to join something like the Secretariat, which didn't appeal, so I didn't do that. In fact, I was probably about 17 and a half, 18 years old, and scene shifting for the Greyshot stages, in which my mother used to perform as a member of the ladies' chorus.
She was an Amdram group, wasn't it?
In various Amdram productions. When the man who played the drums in the band, whose name was Peter Dyer, asked my mother, "What's your lad going to do when he leaves school?" And quite rightly, mother said, "He hasn't really got a clue." To which Peter said, "Well, I'm the assistant principal at Lloyds Bank's training centre at Hindhead. Would Tim like to come on a careers course for a week?" So she said, whether he likes to or not, he's going. So off I trot with my suitcase and go up to Hindhead for this course. And it was just wonderful. I mean, I took to it like a duck to water. They took us to the Stock Exchange. They took us to the clearing centre, which is quite something when you see everything working and all the checks flying around through the machines. Wonderful thing. And I was just hooked. So I applied there and then and joined on the 21st of August 1967.
Lloyds Bank.
Lloyds Bank.
A lot has changed in Lloyds Bank since then.
Yes, indeed.
Which we'll probably get onto in a minute.
The quill pens are long gone.
All right, let's take your second track, and then that's a good point to then talk about your career in banking. This is Eva Cassidy.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Wonderful voice. She was a protege of Terry Wogan and Paul Walters on Wogan's breakfast show, where they not so much discovered her, but promoted her. And this is just a wonderful, magical track.
Fields of Gold.
Fields of Gold.
You remember me when the west wind moves among the fields of barley. You can tell the sun in his jealous sky when we walked in fields of gold. So she took her love for to gaze a while among the fields of barley. In his arms she fell as her hair barley. and you can tell the sun in his jealous sky when we walked in fields of gold. I never made promises lightly, and there have been some that I've broken, but I swear in the days still left we'll walk in fields of gold. We'll walk in fields of gold.
Track Fields of Gold by Eva Cassidy from 1996 and chosen by Tim Phillips, who's my guest in the studio today. Tim, we reached the point where you had taken up a position with Lloyds Bank. Mm-hmm. This is up in Surrey.
Yep.
We should just backtrack very slightly and say there was a bit of a connection with Bells arrived in the early 60s, wasn't there? Because you actually pulled some ropes in Greyshot, didn't you?
I did. The start of my bell ringing career was somewhat embarrassing. The choir mistress at St Luke's Church in Greyshot took me to one side after a choir practice one Thursday evening, and she said to me, "Timothy," she said, "your voice is really not much use to me in its present state. It might be a good idea if you go upstairs and learn to ring the bells, and when your voice has broken properly, perhaps you'd come back and join either the tenors or the basses." Well, I did indeed go upstairs. I never went back to the choir because my voice shattered. It didn't break, and I can't sing for toffee, which is a great shame because I do love singing, but I won't inflict that upon anybody on this show today. So up I go into the belfry at St Luke's in Greyshot, and I'm taught by Graham Yarborough, who was the fishmonger at the time, and by a lady called Rita Moore, who was also in the choir with me, and they really gave me an excellent start in the ability to handle the rope and therefore the bell. So I'm eternally grateful to them.
So that interest was planted?
It was planted. Didn't last all that long. By the time of 17 came around, of course, there were other attractions. I like to say A-levels, but there might have been one or two others. And so I drifted away from ringing, only to come back to it 25 years later.
All right. You were in Lloyds then from the age of 19.
Yes.
This was in Surrey, but banks in those days certainly had a habit of transferring you around a bit, didn't they? And I guess the same applied to you.
I was in Haslemere Branch for 6 months and then moved across to Cranleigh. That lasted a couple of years, and then into Guildford. At that time, they were splitting Guildford Branch into two and hiving off several thousand accounts to a smaller subset of Guildford in Friary Street. And I was there for a while. And then I became an instructor at the Banks Training Centre at Hindhead, where I'd gone on the careers course.
Right. Yes.
That was fascinating.
These were quite well presented places in those days, and I seem to remember from my own banking days that they were quite lavish, some of these training centres, weren't they?
The training centre was extremely plush, if you like. Mm. It was functional, but it was comfortably functional. Mm. We had some comfortable bedrooms, but some wonderful teaching facilities, which, of course, was what it was all about. We also had superb sports facilities there, because it was part of the culture of developing people that you'd see whether they were leaders at sport or whether they were happy to take part. You know, the sort of things that you look for in future management in a bank,
sure,
or indeed anywhere else. So that was a fascinating time. After learning how to be an instructor at Hindhead and having done a course or two there, we were then asked to go into London to work in Victoria Street, which was a sub-branch, if you like, of the training centre at Hindhead, because the intake in London had been huge for a couple of years and they couldn't accommodate them all down at Hindhead. So we went up there and did it. At the time of the three-day week...
Oh, this is the, 1974 then, I suppose.
Yeah, 70s. Mm. Interesting times when you're trying to instruct by candlelight,
yes,
because the electricity's been turned off,
mm,
especially if you're trying to show people how to calculate interest and charges. It was extremely difficult, but really good fun, quite testing. And then we had the facilities at the bank's training sports ground, rather, at Beckenham, so we could take our students to Beckenham for a day's sport and do the same form of assessments down there as we could do at the bank's own centre at Hindhead.
It sounds like you were really enjoying this.
I had a wonderful career in the bank. I just loved every minute of it.
Where else did it take you after that?
After that, I spent probably about 18 months in Fleet and Basingstoke before I got my first junior appointment, which was to the bank's O&M research department, as we used to call it, organisation and methods. It was basically large projects, and that's where my work on projects really started. The big project I was involved in was the automation of the credit clearing. We did it in Lloyds and came up with some specifications, which we then took to NatWest, Barclays, Midland, as it was in those days, and promoted the concept of automating the transfer of bank giro credits between banks.
Which hitherto had been done manually.
Paper and manual, absolutely.
Every one of them had to be keyed manually.
Absolutely. So the code line had to be added. The funny characters on the bottom of a cheque had to be put onto a paying in slip. And at the same time, we realised that a lot of the paper that came through our branches was from utility companies, you know, the gas companies, electricity, water boards and so on, aimed to be paid into their bank accounts at the National Giro in Liverpool. So we had to go up to them and say, look, could we have a common code line that you can use and we can use to direct your paper to you? And they were really delighted to take part in that project. So we ended up being able to process all the bits of paper that came over the counter automatically, which was a great saving. It's good fun, that one.
And on from there, you were at Woking for a while, I think.
Yeah, my first managerial appointment was at Woking. 70 staff. I looked after 40-odd of them. We had thousands of customers, probably 10, 12,000 customers. I had about 800 business accounts to look after and half the personal customers.
And this was 1983.
83.
So yep. That was still the good old days, in inverted commas, when there was a branch manager and you handled all of the activity, both the business accounts and the personal accounts.
Yes.
And you were the man in charge of it.
No, I was the junior manager. The top man was what we call a fifth ball manager. So he was in his fifth managerial appointment. I was in my first. There was a chap in the middle room who was in his third board.
Right.
And I had, therefore, the junior staff, whereas the others had the senior staff. Yeah. And I had the junior business accounts, whereas the other guys had the more complex stuff.
But nonetheless, a portfolio of customers to look after.
Absolutely, and it was wonderful. It's such an enjoyable thing to be able to help people achieve their aims and ambitions. Wonderful.
Mm. And inevitably that came to an end at some point, as these things always did.
One of the things that happened during that was that we started opening again on Saturday mornings, and that was aimed principally at being able to sell products to people who couldn't come in Monday to Friday, because the banking hours, even in those days, were like 9:30 to 3:30, so hardly conducive to working people to come in to talk to us about what they needed. So we started that, and of course that required marketing. So I did an awful lot of work on the marketing side, and that got my name in front of the regional general manager for the southern region, whose office was in Guildford. And my second board appointment was as his PA, which really meant that I was kind of the office dog's body, dealing with complaints and inquiries and all that sort of stuff. But it also meant I got involved in the budgeting and finance aspects of what went on in Southern Region. We then merged with South East Region. The bank had had 16 regions, and we came down to 8 by merging 2 of them. And I found myself working in Tunbridge Wells and later in Tunbridge, and was promoted again in that part. But that then did focus on project work from the point of view of working out how we could charge customers automatically for the services they took. And then I went down to Bristol in probably 91, 92 to work on project work. And that was where more big projects came along.
Lloyd's headquarters was in Bristol in those
Lloyd's
days.
UK retail banking headquarters was in Bristol. We still had the main presence in Lombard Street, where I'd also worked for a few weeks from time to time. But the project work was taken down into Bristol.
Lots of moving around with the bank.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did
it's
they
the
ever,
nature of the beast.
Did they ever send you anywhere you didn't really want to go?
No, you did. You could turn them down. It wasn't necessarily
wasn't a
wise move to turn them down too often. I did decline one move, but all the others were just a pleasure to accept.
Splendid. So you ended up in Bristol then?
Yes.
And you were there until you nominally retired, were you?
nominal retirement number one was when I was 50 years old in 1998. We'd merged with the TSB and adopted a lot of the TSB's computer platforms. And it was a difficult time, and I wasn't enjoying much of the work. There was a lot of kind of internal conflict going on, and I thought, well, actually, I don't need to do this anymore. So I did leave, but within, I don't know, 18, 19 months, I got a phone call saying, look, we're running a project. We'd like you to come and help. We're going to pay you £5 an hour. Would you like to come? Well, I was watching the rain come horizontally down in my house in Chewton Mendip, and I thought, absolutely, I would. So then they rang me back within half an hour and said, we'd like you to lead the Bristol and Severn side part of this project. The rate £7.50 an hour. And I said, well, you know, keep on going and I'll think about it. No, I took it up straight away. That's right. Took it up straight away. And when that project finished, that was a project, by the way, which enabled cashiers to be able to see signatures and signing mandate authority data on their computers on the counter. But when that finished, they then said, look, we've got some big accounting projects going on. We'd like you to be involved, would you stay? So I thought about it for about 3 seconds and said okay, and did that till I put a huge project into the bank in 2008, at which point nominal retirement number two came along.
Okay, that seems like a good point to take your third record, which is Queen, and Is This the World We Created, not one of their better known ones, is
no
it?
I think Queen were just a wonderful band with Freddie in it. And Brian May, of course. And this, because it's an unusual track, I thought we should play for that reason.
Beautiful track there. That's Queen and Is This the World We Created, chosen by Tim Phillips. Tim, we got to the point where you retired once, went back to Lloyd's to do a project.
Yeah.
You retired for a second time in 2008.
I did.
But that wasn't the end of it either.
No, I was involved in a project at that time, nothing to do with banking, to restore the bells in Shepton Mallet Church, which we did, a wonderful project. But I had planned to go to Australia for 6 months, but that proved impractical, so 3 months was chosen. But it had to wait until we'd finished the Shepton Mallet project. So off we went, off to Australia for 3 months, and came back, and just like in 1998, I'm sitting in my cottage watching the rain pour down, and
the phone rings.
And the phone rings. And of course, during that time, HBOS and the banking crisis and all the rest of it had reared its ugly head. And I had a phone call saying, you know, those big systems that you put in 2008, well, they need changing because of the merger. All those branches that HBOS have to be added to your platform. The products have to be changed. Please, could you come and do it? So I thought, okay. Off we go again, but this won't last long. But of course it did. And again, one project led to another, as they often do. And I found myself working on the bank's international currency platform. Lloyds Bank trades in about 45 different currencies, so it maintains accounts for customers in 45 or so currencies. The accounting is quite complicated for that, and it became a real challenge to do it. And at the same time, we were also rewriting our trade platform. So finance for foreign trade, where you advance monies against documentary letters of credit and so on. So that took me up until March 2018. There's a pattern emerging, 98, 2008 and 2018. And I thought, well, after 50 odd years, it's enough. By which time we'd moved to Sherburn about 17, 18 months before that.
You've now taken the phone off the hook, have you?
I think if they ring me up now and say, would you come back, the answer is a firm no. 50 years is enough.
We reflected that you had your first dabbling in bell ringing in the early 60s.
Yes.
When did that come back into your life?
I moved to Camerton in 1992, and the man who came to mend the roof was a chap called Brian Pulsford, who was a ringer at Camerton Church. And my house was 100 yards from the church. And he said, Tim, do any of your lot ring? And I said, well, I used to years ago. He said, Tuesday, 7:30, be there, or I'm not mending your roof. So, of course, I had to go. And, of course, it was just love at second sight, if you like. Mm. I just got straight back into it and really enjoyed it.
But you stayed with the bell ringing then, did you?
Stayed with the bell ringing. Been doing it ever since. Yeah, about 28 years.
And you moved to Sherborne, you say, not that long ago, 2016, wasn't
it? We moved in September 2016, okay. Yes.
And how did your involvement with the Abbey Bells come about?
We moved here because a friend of Helen's, who lives just down the road from us now, said to Helen, there is a house that would suit you two, just five doors down the road from me. Why don't you come and have a look? So, of course, we did.
Because you had no connection to a Sherborne prior to this?
Not direct connections at all, no, neither of us did. But we were only in West Pennard, so it's not, you know, 100 miles away. So we were looking to move in the area, really. But Dorset's wonderful, isn't it? It's just a lovely place. Mm. And so we moved into Sherborne, into that house, and Kate, our friend, discovered that I was a ringer, and her neighbour was a ringer at the Abbey, Carol Campbell Pitt. And Kate said, you must ring Carol. So I rang Carol, and Carol said, you must be here in my car at 7:15 next Tuesday evening. Well, you didn't argue with Carol. She was just the loveliest lady. Sadly, she died last year, but we all miss her furiously. Such a shame she's gone. But she took me down and she said, right, come on, I'll introduce you to everybody. And it was just wonderful because the band is such a friendly band. You don't get that very often. And when you find a band that is as nice to ring with as the group we have here, you want to stay there forever. It's just marvellous.
Now, we know you've got eight bells down there, but yes. I imagine you have more than eight ringers.
We've got between 20 and 25 ringers. We have people learning. We've two young girls aged 10 and 9 who are learning. We have an older lady, I won't say her age, who is learning. We have another lady who's just retired, so that gives you a clue as to what her age might be, and she's just learning. And we've been teaching people almost for as long as I've been there.
And somebody comes along and says, I want to learn how to ring bells.
Yes.
What's the first thing you do with them?
We take them up into the ringing room and show them what it's like. We give them a kind of demonstration. They sit and watch us practice. We'll take them up into the belfry and show them the bells that are up there and explain which is which and how they work. We have a model in the belfry which we can demonstrate how it works so they can see the bell turning full circle both ways. And then slowly but surely we let them have a go. Not all at once, you know. We show them the backstroke first. We show them the handstroke separately. And then we put the two together and then we concentrate on their feel for the bell. And then we start to talk to them about the rhythm of ringing. And then we start to talk to them about the way they must listen and see where their bell strikes in relation to the others in the sequence.
And so, what makes a good bell ringer?
a good sense of rhythm, I think, is really helpful.
Ability to climb a lot of steps, presumably, as well.
Yeah, there are 77 steps up to the Abbey, so I still blow a bit by the time I get to the top. So it's essential that you're mobile.
Is there any physical attributes, though? Because some of these bells, as we've said, are very heavy.
No, as I say, it is about technique. The way you handle a bell will determine how easy it is for you to ring a bell of a particular weight. Light bells are difficult to ring. Very light bells are quite difficult to ring. There's a different technique to ringing the heavy bells at the Abbey. But the bells at the Abbey are really quite forgiving in the sense that once you get them moving, they stay moving unless you do something daft. Mm. But we don't encourage our ringers to do anything daft.
I imagine not.
No. So it's a it'll take people several weeks to learn. It may take several months, but we will not give up on them, providing they wish to continue. And so we end up with lots of people who like to ring.
So you have something, the band. Something like three times the number of ringers than you have bells from the
we
numbers
do.
You just gave
me. We are extremely
so do
lucky.
Do you fight on a Sunday morning
No. The band is of different abilities. There are people who can ring methods, and there are people who can ring call changes, and there are people who are just starting to ring and therefore can probably just ring rounds.
Yeah.
And we accommodate all those abilities, both on Sunday mornings, at weddings occasionally, and at our practices on a Tuesday night.
So there's plenty of opportunity for people to get involved.
Loads of opportunity. If you want to get involved, the simple thing to do is to look at our website, which is www.sherborneabbeybellringers.com. If you look on the contacts section, you'll find the name of our tower captain, John Kaywood, who used to be a doctor in Yeovil, lives in Longburton now. And you'll also find Jan Cahane's name. She's our tower contact. So get in contact with either of them and we'll accommodate you, take you up the tower, show you what's what, and you can see if you want to join us or not.
Tell us about the book then, The Bells of Sherborne Abbey, The Heaviest Ring of Eight in the World, and it's Peter Sewell and Catherine Barker, just published not long ago.
Yes.
How did this come about? Somebody decided it ought to be documented.
Yes. About 10 years ago, Peter, who is one of our ringers, decided that it would be a good idea to think about writing a book about the bells. He had seen that other major churches in England have books about their bells. Indeed, I believe that Wells Cathedral have just published one about theirs. And so he set to writing what's now part two of this book, a history of the bells in the abbey, how they're rung, that sort of thing. And then when it was reviewed, we thought that, or rather the Reverend Eric Woods, the then vicar of Sherborne, now the rector, felt that it might be helpful if there was a historical section giving some context to bells and bell ringing generally, which is where Catherine came in. Catherine's the president of the Sherborne Museum. She's a very well-known local historian, and she's put together part one. And so that's how the book came to be born. It was actually born on the 1st of December last year. We had 500 or so copies printed, and we have less than 50 left, so it's gone really well.
Will you print some more, or maybe leave that?
We will indeed print some more. I don't think I'm anticipating something that won't happen. I'm very hopeful that we will print another stock. There are books in, copies of the book in the Abbey bookshop, of course, in the Abbey itself, on the bookstall, at Winston's, in the museum, and at the Tourist Information Centre. So if anybody wants to go buy one, you can do that. Or, of course, you can buy online at our website.
It's a very nicely written little book, and it's superbly illustrated as well. There's lots of historical photographs as well as up-to-date ones.
There's some wonderful ones.
And, yes, I commend it. It's very readable.
Yeah, it is.
Let's take your fourth track, because we're running short on time.
Okay.
This is George Ezra and Budapest.
Yes, just a bit different, this one.
My house in Budapest, my hidden treasure chest, golden grand piano, my beauty focus, E.O.U. Ooh, you, ooh, I'd leave it all. My acres of a land I've achieved, it may be hard for you to stop and believe, but for you, ooh, you, ooh, I'd leave it all. For you, ooh, you, ooh, I'd leave it all. And give me one good reason why I should never make a change. And baby, if you owe me, then all of this will go away. My many artifacts, the list goes on. If you just say the words, I'll up and run. Oh, to you, ooh, you, ooh, I'd leave it all.
both of you. Ooh, ooh, I'd leave it all. Give me one good reason why I should never make a change. Baby, if you want me, then all of this will go away. Give me one good reason why I should never make a change.
Well, we're going to have to fade George Ezra out there in Budapest. What's the sort of cross-section of your current bell rings? I'm guessing that they're from all walks of life, are they?
Yes, all walks of life. Many of us are retired because that's a function of the nature of the town, almost. We could do, ladies and gentlemen, quite frankly, with some young new blood. As I mentioned, we've got a 10-year-old and a 9-year-old. They're both young girls, and we're teaching them. So here's a challenge to you. If you're from 8 or 9 or 10 years old, right up to 80, we'd be happy to teach you. Come along. The commitment is that you come on a Tuesday evening to practice with us. The quid pro quo is that we always go to the pub afterwards. If you'd like to join us, that's always a benefit. That's where we get to talk about ringing and plan events that are centred around the ringing. And, of course, a Sunday morning. Now, the whole purpose of ringing is to draw people to services at the Abbey on Sunday morning, and that's what we do every Sunday without fail. So that's the commitment, really, that we're looking for.
And I imagine you do visits to other towers from time to time, do you?
From time to time, yes. I think I rang in 6 or 7 different towers last week. So there's a huge amount of ringing activity that can be done. Only yesterday I was down at Bradpole on a handling course. This is a course for people who wish to improve the quality of their handling of a bell, which will make improve their confidence and make it easier for them to ring the thing. And that was a very successful course. Great fun.
And I know there are different echelons of bell ringing. There's something called the college youth, isn't there? That, is that like a some kind of qualification you've got to get for that?
You have to be invited to join.
I see.
There are several societies. The famous two are the Royal Society of Cumberland Youths and the Ancient Society of College Youths, both of which were founded, I think, about 300 years ago, maybe even 400 years ago. And you are invited to join. And the qualification is that you are a regular peal ringer. Peals last 3-4 hours. There are 5,000 changes roughly. It's a very difficult thing to achieve well. So if you are a competent, aspirational peal ringer, you may well be invited to join one of these two societies.
I see. Well, that's getting ahead of ourselves.
It is. It's way ahead. Yeah, absolutely way ahead.
But if you're interested, get in contact, what you're saying, really. And it doesn't matter how old you are or how young
you are. It doesn't matter
at
all. No. As long as you can climb the stairs, that's the only qualification that we stipulate at the Abbey.
Do you need anything else for people that aren't interested in going and actually ringing but would be quite interested in helping you out? Presumably there's always a need for money.
There is a need for money, but it's rather more focused on the training aspects. There are central training facilities that we offer at Bradpole. We're currently in the middle of, or just starting, a series of 3 courses for people to come along out of their own tower and improve what they're doing. These things cost money. Bradpole has in it a computer which is linked to sensors on the bells. The clappers are tied so we don't disturb the outside population for hours on end while people are clashing around, potentially learning what to do. So we can tie the clappers, as I say, and we put photoelectric cells on the wheel and the frame, and the computer makes the sound as the photoelectric cells are triggered. So that's a really good mechanism, and that, of course, cost a little bit of money to put in. But it's there, and it needs to be used, and the more we use it, the better.
So technology
is... Technology is great in ringing.
In the world of bell ringing as well, where you might not expect to find it. What about the actual physical bells in, well, in any church, really? Do they just sit there for hundreds of years and don't require any maintenance?
No, they do require maintenance. Most of the large churches have regular maintenance contracts with bell hangers. Ours is with Andrew Nicholson down at Bridport. The It's a good thing to have them regularly looked at, perhaps every 5 years or so. Sometimes if you don't do that, you end up with a lot of work being done at a lot of expense, which might have been avoided.
I imagine they rotate on bearings of some sort, do they?
They are on roller bearings enclosed in a bearing housing.
Which need to be greased regularly.
They don't need to be greased that often, but ropes need to be maintained because they can break. The wheels are a delicate mechanism in some respects and need to be maintained properly. There are pulleys that might need to be looked at and frequently wear, so need to be replaced, all sorts of stuff.
The bell itself, presumably, is a fairly robust
item. The bell itself is very robust.
Yes, it doesn't need to be maintained
all
that much.
No, but the clapper within it can, because that runs on its own type of bearing.
I see. Tim, we've run out of time, well, we've more than run out of time, actually, but no matter. What next for you? We've already said the phone is definitely disconnected now, so you're not about to take another sojourn back into Lloyd's.
No, I'm obviously involved in ringing a lot. I go out and do that. But when I made the decision to retire from the bank in July 2017, I asked Sherburn Town Council if I could put my name on the allotment waiting list, and thankfully, one came up in January, and I have an allotment at Westbridge Park, which I thoroughly enjoy tending. And as it's a huge allotment, there are only two of us at home, I'm able to take spare produce to my ringing friends and other neighbours in the season. So that's another great thing I do.
So no major projects coming along?
No major projects that I'm currently aware of.
Tim, it's been great talking to you. We're going to go out with your final track, Barcelona, Freddie Mercury and Montserrat Caballé.
Yes, I could have had all five Queen tracks, but I thought that was a bit excessive. But this one, because it's got Freddie at his best, I couldn't resist.
It sounds like some bells at the beginning as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Tim Phillips, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank
we wish you,
Terry.
Well.
Thank you very much.
Shit! That's the night.